KPCW News Time now, 8:09. Good morning. Well, the town of Hideout in Wasatch County is considering expanding its municipal boundaries in a pretty major way. Hideout Town Manager Jan McCosh joins me now to preview the town's Planning Commission meeting tomorrow. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So the Planning Commission there having the first of two meetings then, but three meetings total to discuss and take public input on the town's proposed annexation policy plan and annexation expansion area. We've talked with Park City Manager Diane Foster about it, but you tell us why Hideout is looking at its expansion area and why it's taking steps towards annexation.
Sure, Leslie. Let's first back up and say, what is the town really doing? And who is Hideout? Where are they? So many people say, Hideout, is that in Utah? Let's back up to what the town is doing with its annexation policy plan. It's a state-mandated document. It's required of municipalities. And we've simply been putting together this plan in coordination with a general plan. So many people hear the word annexation and they think, oh no, we're actively, you know, pursuing expansion of the town, when in actuality that's really not the case. An annexation proposal is done by a different sort of process. Landowners have to agree to be annexed. This is not something a town can simply say, oh, we want a land grab, we want to include all of this in our town. So an annexation policy plan is a forward-looking document. It asks the town to look out 20 years, look at any possibility we would have in expanding the town boundaries, take a look at future development in 20 years. What would that look like if citizens came to us and asked us to be included in the town? What would that possibly look like? And that's what we're going through, rather than some kind of procedure to acquire property.
All right. You don't have an annexation policy plan? That's why you're doing it?
That's correct. So last year, our mayor, who has been in office for almost 18 months, noticed we didn't have a general plan and began the process of putting in the plan. We had several meetings, and this annexation policy plan is part of our general plan. So we're simply coming into compliance and creating a bigger picture of what we could possibly look like in 20 years.
All right. Then why would you, though, knowing that you would need permission from bordering, you know, what that plan includes, if you ever did want to annex that property, why would you even include Park City-owned parcels when we're looking at the Quinns Junction area?
Right. You know, That is a good question, and I understand why Park City would be alarmed when they found out we had them in in the plan. I would have done the same thing if I were Diane. I would, you know, jump into the mix, and I'm actually grateful that she did, because it has opened up a fantastic opportunity to communicate with other members in our surrounding municipalities. And this needs to be a cooperation, a collaboration. We need to think regionally. And back to your question, why would we include property? A policy plan can include overlapping areas. It really is just an idealistic plan, and our planning commissioner looked at the natural boundaries, looked at roadways, looked at what made sense geographically as a beginning to creating this plan. But let me back up and talk about who Hideout is. Again, people are like, Hideout? Where is that? Even in our small community, people don't really understand where it is. So if you're on Highway 40 traveling toward Heber, you look left and see the Jordanelle. Hideout is a little area on the east bank, a development of homes over there. It geographically is very difficult because it's a little area that actually exists in Wasatch County, sandwiched between Summit County on the west and the east. So if you are driving on Kearns Boulevard, which is 248, and you're heading out of town, at about 2.5 miles past Highway 40, you'll find Hideout. The sort of fascinating thing about it is, in less than 4 miles, you run into Summit County again. So geographically, we have some difficult limitations. In fact, our kids have to travel an hour to get to schools because we're part of the Wasatch County system. Our residents come into Park City on 248 for gas and groceries, or go to Camas. But in a survey, it seems we're more a bedroom community of Park City.
You also, we should note, Todd Hollow, and I don't know if that's what it's still called, but the affordable income apartments across 248 are also part of Hideout.
That's correct, and they are called Deer Mountain Affordable Housing.
Okay. So the draft annexation policy plan lists 9 goals as reasons for wanting to expand: increasing livability for residents, increasing connectivity. I mean, why does Hideout need to increase its boundaries to achieve those goals?
Yes, good question. That's another difficulty we face. I don't know if you know, under a very short-lived law, a developer incorporated into a town. And we're more of a development than we are a town. So we have no public spaces. We have no public parks, no school, no amenities that a typical town has. In fact, most of the landmass is owned by the developer who incorporated. So in order to achieve some of our goals of community and community spaces and livability and quality of life, we need to annex more land.
So that you can build the gas station and the grocery store and things like that?
Exactly. We have almost no commercial. I say almost no because we have a golf course which is owned by the developer or an entity of the developer. That's the only commercial property in the town that we have.
Yeah. So what's the connectivity piece of this?
The connectivity piece.
Yeah, I mean that was one of the 9 goals as reasons to expand, to increase connectivity.
Oh, I think again it's going back to the geographical limitations. Our citizens are sometimes confused. We have a Summit County zip code. We get our mail in Camas. We, it's like the town is sort of this piece sandwiched. So we don't have a contiguous land mass available to call our town. So if you look at the policy plan map, it makes a landmass that makes more sense.
So a lot of the land that Hideout looking to annex is featured in the Military Installation Development Authorities. We know it as MIDA's resort project area. How is Hideout working with MIDA through this annexation policy plan?
Leslie, thank you for bringing that up. I think, Tom Clyde has spoken about MIDA, and I think we need to have those discussions as a region. MIDA is very complicated because it brings state land authority into the picture. Very complicated issues when you're dealing from the perspective of a small town, because it takes, in essence, those land use decisions out of the hands of the residents, placing it in state authority, and no one at the state level is living in that area being developed.
Yeah. The way I've heard it described is that MIDA is courting Hideout. Do you need them more than, or do they need you more than you need them?
Yes, absolutely. And that's, I've reached out to Summit County Planning, where we have excellent skill in Pat Putt and others in the planning department. And yes, we do need to have some very careful analysis, because in essence, I feel sometimes like it requires a crystal ball to be able to look out and say, how is this going to work, you know, 20, 30 years out? And then is this MIDA project just a fantasy project? There are so many variables, so many things we need to take into consideration looking that far out and deciding today what we need to have a viable community in the future.
So, I mean, if this for Hideout is an issue of trying to collect more property taxes through commercial development, I guess the question is, why would you even go along with MIDA? Because under the rules, they keep 75% of all new property taxes under this tax increment financing for at least the next 15 years. I mean, that's what you're looking for, is that commercial tax base. So why would you kind of hand it over to MIDA? I mean, what are they offering in return for something like that?
Well, MIDA starts with the developer and offers them some very good deals, some deals too sweet to pass up. And then the developer, in turn, comes to the town to work through that deal. So it requires the town to really be forward thinking again. But why would we do that? Because if you're a development with no park, with no public places, this is an opportunity to work with the developer and get those pieces of land. I have this huge appreciation for all of the trails and open spaces that Park City has now, just dealing with the difficulty of actually acquiring land and the cooperation and coordination it takes with the landowner to get these public and open spaces.
Yeah, so what's the good deal that you're getting?
The good deal would be, well, it's a deal, not necessarily a good deal. That's the homework. Is this a good deal? The deal is we get parks, we get community spaces by dealing with the land owner, who is now a developer.
So what kind of developments would you be interested in? I mean, to help shore up the tax base. I mean, we kind of heard maybe big box retail or a hotel, or, I mean, what are you talking about?
Oh, you know, that is another issue altogether. And again, I think we need some good planning advice, because certainly we don't want to repeat the errors of Kimball Junction, for instance. And I've been a long time county resident and have seen some of the struggles that we've created by not having very qualified planning advice. And it's the very, very reason I'm really reaching out to the community, to Summit County, less to Wasatch County, but we're involving Wasatch County in these discussions. We're coordinating and having breakfast meeting coming up, and we really want to be a team player and make sure we get our growth right.
Yeah, so again, looking at that commercial development, what are you thinking about? I mean, what makes sense for your community?
We're not. we're not at that phase of thinking of what exactly it entails. We have no plans there other than we know we need some commercial.
All right. So what we had heard from City Manager Diane Foster was that when the Hideout Town Council was scheduled to vote on the annexation policy plan, it was realized that you had not noticed Park City Municipal, so you kind of had to go back to square one. How did you miss out on that?
That's a good question. The policy plan predates me, and I know we've been talking for over a year on our general plan, and that includes the policy plan. But you know, whether or not we missed one of the technicalities, we've had a clerk who's been out on medical leave, and rather than trying to dial down on, oh, what detail did we miss, we're team players. And if Diane wants us to start over, it's like, great, and thank you for coming into the mix, and let's do this properly, and let's get everybody's input.
Okay, and I know you're scheduled to kind of complete the process by your August 8th town council meeting. That then puts your plan into place. Does that then negate anything Park City would try to do?
Does that negate? No, it doesn't.
I mean, it's not like a little land war race here.
No, it is absolutely not a land grab. And we can have overlapping plans. Our plan can exist on somebody else's, you know, the piece of property can be in two different plans, and that's totally fine. What will happen is, by statute, we are required to include these comments that come back to us that we do not want to be in your policy plan. We're required to put a note to that effect that Park City does not want this property in the plan. And there are some limitations, we know. I mean, I've recently learned about the Flagstaff annexation and some long ago planning that would not allow us to agree to bring a piece of property into our town boundary.
Okay, I need to leave it there. I know you do stream your meetings live. Do you have an audio archive of the recordings? Or
we do have audio recordings. Again, we're experiencing some difficulties in. We have a part-time person that we just hired for our clerk position, and we have a backlog, unfortunately, that we're trying to get up to speed. But we do have audio recordings, and we should be in compliance soon. So anyone is welcome to stop in and have access to prior meetings. So we have that available.
Okay, but you're not going to post them on the website?
We are.
Eventually.
We will be, yes.
Okay. All right, Jan. Hey, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Jan McCosh is the town administrator for Hideout. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:28. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Council will meet in a closed session tomorrow at 3 o'clock. The work session begins at 4:15 with interviews of three applicants to fill an unexpired term on a position of the Historic Preservation Board. In the studio with a preview of some of the other items on the agenda, I have Park City Assistant City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's see, at 5 o'clock, a discussion regarding the $75,000 contribution to Friends of the Children's Justice Center. I thought I heard earlier that the city can't contribute since it's not a city organization. So what's changed?
No, it's a fair question. Typically, we can't contribute with capital funds. Once we allocate funding towards a capital budget, we can't then use those funds to help support a piece of property or something that we wouldn't actually own. So this is operating budget money. Previous year money that we would be carrying forward, and so it has a little bit extra flexibility. And councils signaled pretty early on that they were very interested in providing some level of support for the Children's Justice Center. I mean, obviously, it's one of our most vulnerable populations, and so the financial team has put together a $75,000 proposal for their consideration.
So where does the money come from? I know we cut out a bunch of money to help pay down Treasure, and it was kind of like, you know, the bank is empty, but now we've got another $75,000?
No, very fair, and I think that's the reason we're so late in the game. Typically, we would have done something like this during our budget process, but we were just unable. Funds were very, very tight this year. This is previous year money that's contingency money. So our fiscal year closed on the 30th, and we're now 2 or 3 weeks into a new fiscal year. And our analysts hold back a little bit of money in the event that we have a budget that goes over budget or revenues and expenditures don't line up. And so our folks are feeling a little bit more confident. There's a little bit more certainty that there aren't any outstanding invoices that we might need to cover.
Okay. Well, we've got a huge project there on Park Avenue with the water main break. I mean, that has the water department has its own contingency fund then?
It does.
It's not going to need this money?
Indeed.
Okay. Let's see. At 520 then, a carbon footprint update. This is something I think you do quarterly. Discussion about buildings and outdoor lights, which make up almost a third of the city's carbon footprint. The report shows that we saw a decrease in 2017, but then things jumped again up 1,000 metric tons. How come?
No, they did, and I think this is important for the community to know. We obviously have very, very aggressive goals when it comes to bringing Park City Municipal to net zero and then eventually the community. And so we've got to walk the walk here, and we check in quarterly to see where our carbon footprint is going. The way I like to think of it is there's sort of three buckets. One is our buildings and lighting. The other is our water department and water consumption and transportation. And so we're obviously focusing on buildings. And what happened over the past year is we acquired some new properties, quite frankly. And we had other properties that we kept open longer and later, such as the Mark and the library. We had expanded hours. And in particular, the mine bench is a new property that we took on. It's an old, sort of antiquated mining building. That we're going to have to do a lot of work over the next year. And so sustainability staff is coming back. We're going to do a building envelope exercise, and we're going to start transitioning most of our buildings towards electric heat and off of natural gas.
So as you noted, the Mark, the biggest user of electricity and natural gas of all of the city buildings, how do we fix that?
Well, we are being very, very aggressive over this next year, doing an analysis on each municipal building, its footprint, the type of energy it's consuming. And in particular, you're going to see us transition, like I mentioned, from natural gas to electricity. And the reason that this is critical is during the last legislative session, we were able to work with Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, Summit County, and enable a renewable energy bill, House Bill 411. And so when we're able to transition our consumptive type of energy to solar renewable energy, we'll be able to reduce our consumption of natural gas, which should take these building footprint numbers way down.
Okay. So you're still thinking that you're going to meet that 2022 goal of being net zero, huh?
Yeah, I think we are. We're bullish. We think we can get there. I don't think, myself included, there was anyone, probably except for Luke Carton and some of the sustainability folks, and some members of council that thought we could push through the type of legislation that we did. It was really remarkable. I've worked in the state of Utah now for about 6 years, and I regularly work with the legislature, and that was quite an achievement. So kudos to all those people. But that is critical for Park City Municipal and for the community to reach its energy goals.
The Recreation Department has installed free wireless in City Park. I mean, is that a good idea? Aren't there just some places that should discourage people off of their phones?
Well, I don't know. I guess I didn't think of it that way. I guess we think of it as a gathering place for the community. We have all sorts of night games and sports leagues. You know, I bring my children down there on weekends. And I think it is an amenity that we have to be, you know, we have to be realistic, and that we're going to allow people to make that choice for themselves. And so for the public that visits the Mark and visits the library, the system will be more or less exactly the same. It's Park City's guest network, and we think it's going to be a nice amenity. If you're there with your kids and they have a soccer game and maybe someone needs to do some work and they're, you know, juggling summer camps and other things, we think it's going to be a good amenity for the community.
Okay. Again, I mean, there just should be some protected places. People get their face out of their phones. Anyway, another amendment to the Three Kings Water Treatment Plan, and not that I want to speak about that, but I do want to talk about Thanes Canyon Drive. My understanding was it was supposed to open last Friday. As of yesterday afternoon, still closed. You know what's going on?
I'd have to follow up on that. Sorry. I'm off the top of my head, I'm not sure.
Okay, then a resolution regarding the city's position on the preferred alternative for State Route 248. This is going to be a joint resolution with Summit County, basically saying that you don't like the preferred alternative because it's not in line with the city's transportation goals and policies. You want a commitment from UDOT, though, to work together to identify a multimodal project. So what's multimodal?
Well, I mean, to be fair, you couldn't have said it any better. That's exactly the case. The current plan that was proposed for 248 is inconsistent with our values and our goals. And so a multimodal corridor is a corridor that promotes other types of travel. That includes bike, transit, walking. So it's a multimodal corridor that supports other modes of travel beyond just the single occupancy vehicle. And the problem with the current design is it really promotes use of the single occupancy vehicle. And so we are seeking, after weeks and probably months of community input and feedback, we're seeking a better outcome with UDOT. And they've been a wonderful partner. I think, like anyone, they've put a lot of time, a lot of labor, a lot of logistical and expert analysis into this. And they, too, want something that has local context, is sensitive to who Park City is, our historic values and character. And so they're looking for a better outcome as well.
So what does this mean, that we have to redo everything?
No, I don't think we have to redo everything. I just think what you'll probably see is a project that has better context. It's probably a little bit more episodic and has phases as opposed to just doing everything at once and widening the corridor. So you're going to see the other values that we support beyond the single occupancy vehicle or even higher, such as transit, such as biking, such as walking. You're going to see those values elevated in the new design.
Okay.
Given more importance, more credence to those.
Yeah. Any guess that UDOT's like, sure, let's do this?
We have thought a lot about that, and we've had some very good conversations. Our elected officials have obviously done a lot of work, and we've been thankful for Summit County's partnership. But the mindset's changing. I travel around the state a little bit with work and working with the legislature. And, our folks in St. George and Draper and Ogden and Provo, we are not the only ones experiencing this sort of new paradigm where our values have changed. And so this is happening around the state. And I think what you're going to see, like any good entity, like any good governmental entity, is you're going to see UDOT have some amendments, make some changes, and be more progressive in their design.
Okay. Also, there's a $40,000 request for a summer onboard transit survey. What do we want to find out?
Well, so this is actually sort of the sister agreement to the winter onboard transit survey that we do. As some folks in the community know, we have new leadership in our transit and transportation department. Alfred Knotts is the interim transportation manager. We brought on board Jerry Benson, who's the former head of the Utah Transit Authority. And this is very, very critical. I'm told it's an industry standard that you have sort of your two peak seasons. You typically do a survey every year or every other year. And so this is the beginning of something that we'll see over time. We want to have a longitudinal or a collection of questions and feedback over time so we can assess how the transit system's doing, how we're doing in customer service, and then pour that information into our route planning for efficiency, where routes are. And I think these folks are level setting. They want to start new and have a baseline of new information.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about that? What has happened to the transit transportation team? A year ago, we had a transit director who had a team of three managers, a transit quality manager, a transit systems manager, and a transit business manager. Now we have none. What are they? They're all gone.
Not exactly. So we did have, we did suffer some attrition, and we did do some reorganization. And that's not always an easy time for an organization to go through. I think our goals are pretty straightforward. We are very, very aggressively pursuing a transit first methodology, and we need an organization and skill sets and professionals that reflect those values. So we're really confident in the new team that we have down there in particular. And this survey, we hope, is something that's going to help guide us moving forward. So in the winter, we interviewed well over 1,100 individuals, all sorts of feedback about the timing of routes, where routes are running, what type of transit. Should it be a 52-foot bus, or could it be a different type of vehicle? The amenities that people seek when they're at a bus stop waiting for the bus. Do they need Wi-Fi? Do they want a better bus stop, out of the elements? So this information is going to be really important to us moving forward.
Okay, so you did get some good information then out of the winter one?
Very good. And so that was highlighted about 3 weeks ago with City Council. And then if the public is interested, again, like I said, it was a very, very robust survey. It was over 1,100 respondents. And that information is also included in this week's staff report before council. So that information is available again to the public.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, thank you.
All right. Matt Dias again, Park City Assistant City Manager. Thanks. It's 8:40. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, news that immigration and customs enforcement or ICE operations would take place around the country had communities on edge over the weekend. Joining me by phone to talk about immigration law and enforcement, I have Mark Alvarez. He is an attorney in Utah who specializes in immigration cases. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So ICE operations scheduled to happen in a few large cities across the country. None from Utah were on the list. What did you hear, though, from people in Utah?
Well, the news that there were going to be immigration operations was quite spread by the media. And a lot of people thought, even though there were 10 cities designated for the immigration operations, that immigration ICE would go further than those 10 cities and start to affect raids nationwide, which is not the case. And many nonprofits and I have been trying to educate people about the scope of the immigration operations. But just the news and also Donald Trump tweeting and speaking on the issue raised people's anxieties significantly.
Yeah. The people who were said to be on ICE lists for those operations had deportation orders against them. Recent reporting has shown that other people can get caught up in those operations as well when officers start asking people in a household what their status is. Have we seen any of that here in Utah?
We've seen incidents of it. I can't give a specific example of it, but yes, we've seen incidences, and I guess maybe I can make an analogy. Sometimes when an immigration officer will go to a house, he or she will ask to enter. Oftentimes, people can actually refuse entry to an ICE officer unless there's a judicial warrant. But the ICE officer will go in and start asking indiscriminately, won't ask just the person who may be the target of the operation, but will ask others. Others do get caught up in those types of operations. For example, an immigration officer might be looking for somebody who has a criminal record, but on entering a house may start asking anybody who's present about immigration status. If some of those people answer and they're out of status, it may be that ICE officer takes the initiative to place the person in proceedings.
Yeah, there was a lot of fear instilled over the weekend here in Park City. Somebody posted a photo of a supposed Border Patrol vehicle here in Park City. When I saw the photo, it was kind of like, no way. I mean, it was this big, bold graphics, graphic wraps on the vehicle. It was just too colorful and too grandiose to have been a Border Patrol vehicle. But have you heard of things like this, people detailing their cars just to appear to be ICE or Border Patrol?
I have, and I've also, one point I would make is a Border Patrol vehicle would not be seen here in Utah. There is, the Border Patrol has authority to arrest people within a certain distance of the border, but they would not come up to Utah. Now, there could be ICE vehicles. What I've seen and what I've heard, because I used to do a Spanish language radio show, I remember very specifically, somebody called in and said ICE was affecting an operation in a local Walmart. I kept that from the air and didn't, tried to cut the conversation short. I went over to Walmart and there was a misunderstanding that somebody had thought a police vehicle might be an immigration, it might be part of an immigration operation, which wasn't the case. But yes, rumors spread quickly, and unfortunately, bad information also spreads quickly. And if a journalist or somebody on the radio or in print, wherever they may be, isn't alert to some of the problems with bad information, they may spread a rumor that really has no foundation in fact.
Yeah. So again, because that's exactly what we were seeing, as you mentioned, businesses, daycare centers, things like that were, apparently something like that was happening. So it's just fear and rumor, huh?
It is. And I think, I've actually been up to Park City to give presentations on immigration, just general community sessions where I try to give a general presentation on what the immigration system, what ICE officers may do, and also how people can defend themselves. I think knowing your rights is one of the most important things, not only an undocumented immigrant can do, but also people around that person, so that people don't kind of cave in or they don't fall for rumors. But it's unfortunate in a place like Park City where we know, and the reality is we know in certain industries, undocumented people are working. A little bit, some rumors mixed with the anxiety can cause maybe not panic, but something very close to it.
There's a lot of political rhetoric around who the immigrants without documentation are. Can you help us understand, get a fuller understanding of the clients you work with and their status here? Are these the ones sneaking across the border? Or are they simply outstaying their visas?
Well, that's a good point. Right now, more people are becoming undocumented by coming into the country with visas or with some documents and overstaying the limit on the visa or the travel document. Many years ago, that was not the case. Most people who were here without documents had come across the border. But I would go a little further than even trying to put people in these categories. The truth of it is, and these are from the United States government's published statistics on this, the median undocumented immigrant in the United States has lived here for more than 13 years. And so these are not people who have recently overstayed visas or sneaked across the border. These are people who have been living here for more than a decade. And so while the, especially the asylum seekers and some of the things with migrant caravans, they draw a lot of media attention, I think less attention is paid to the fact, I know this is true in Park City, that a lot of the people working and living there who are undocumented have worked and lived there for many, many years, probably over a decade.
Yeah. I mean, and to work, I mean, you must have documents. You've got to have a Social Security card. You've got to have a driver's license or a passport. So are those that are here, I mean, are they're using fabricated documents? Or, I mean, or are we talking identity fraud here?
Yeah, I don't think it's identity fraud. Now, I'm not going to say they're not working without documents because a lot of people do have some type of document. Usually, though, it's not the document was not created from somebody else's identity. A lot of times the number is just taken out of the air and given as a Social Security number. Now, those numbers won't match oftentimes in the Social Security Administration's database, but the Social Security Administration has been reluctant to send no-match letters on a broad scale for many, many years because I think people in government know that would cause havoc in certain parts of our economy. It certainly would cause havoc in the ski industry in Park City.
Yeah.
And government officials at the national level, government officials locally as well, I'm sure Governor Herbert and people who are working in his administration know this. They don't want a federal crackdown to the extent that it would harm important industries here in the state of Utah. And I guess that's one of the rubs of immigration policy. We really should be discussing reasonable, rational ways to fix an immigration system that really isn't working for a lot of people and for a lot of businesses. Unfortunately, most of the talk on immigration is about protecting our own, be it culture, be it schools, be it our economy. For example, I don't think Governor Herbert would be clamoring to try to have immigration take good workers from Park City out of the ski industry, out of the hospitality industry. But I don't hear a lot of Utah politicians standing up to Donald Trump, who has said pretty racist and pretty anti-immigrant things over the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. I mean, so we have this so-called E-Verify system, but, I mean, we're just not using it because if it was used correctly, it would show up. I mean, right, that somebody may not be legally documented.
That's right. I stand for very broad immigration reform and pretty liberal immigration reform, most people would characterize. But E-Verify is not a bad system in a reformed immigration system. Because you're right, E-Verify, if implemented, if used correctly, probably would deal pretty effectively with people who are working here without documents. But if workers have been working here without documents for 10, 15 years, they've become important workers in important industries at the local level, at the state level, at the national level. I think it would be wrong for us to try to implement E-Verify without doing a broad reform of the entire system. But you're right. I guess, and to answer your question, I guess maybe more specifically, E-Verify in most aspects is a voluntary system. Mm. And so it's mandatory for some businesses, but even in Utah law and federal law, sometimes it's mandatory in quotation marks. Here we see, okay, that's the law, but it's not really a part of the law that's being enforced.
Let's talk just briefly about immigration violations. I guess I was surprised that some are misdemeanors, some are simply civil infractions.
Well, the problem is immigration is a civil system. It's not a criminal system. And so I actually, now that said, there are some, for example, an immigration violation. If somebody has crossed the border and is found within a certain distance of the border, that person can be prosecuted for a criminal violation. But being here without documents is not a criminal offense, it's a civil offense. And one important point is some people have talked about criminalizing immigration offenses. That would be incredibly expensive for the United States and for localities. In the criminal justice system, somebody has a right to an attorney paid for by the state if the person can't afford an attorney. In the immigration system, the right to an attorney exists, but there is no right to a public defender. Not only that, immigration cases are decided by immigration judges. If immigration violations were criminalized, the defendants would have a right to a trial by jury, which would add quite a lot of expense onto an already burdened system. And so I don't think it's accurate to characterize immigration violations as misdemeanors or infractions. They're civil offenses, not criminal offenses.
Okay. So if somebody is pulled over for, just a traffic stop, found not to have the correct documents, I mean, what is it that they're charged with?
If they don't have status, they would be charged in the immigration court, unlawful presence in the United States. And now that said, it's highly unlikely that an immigrant stopped, lawful or unlawful, documented or undocumented, it's highly unlikely that a person at a traffic, if you're caught speeding, would end up in an immigration proceeding. The vast majority of cases that we see as immigration attorneys, if there's some criminal offense involved as well, are people who have to go to jail. In the jails, there's a process that determines whether or not a person is a citizen or a resident, documented or undocumented. It's at that point, if the criminal violation is serious enough, that ICE may step in. So a traffic stop is, the chances are, I can't guarantee it just for ethical reasons, but the chances of a speeding stop resulting in somebody having to face immigration charges, that's very, very low.
All
now,
right.
That said, a person, for example, a person who commits a DUI driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs, if that person is undocumented, has to go to jail for a few days or a few weeks, there is certainly an elevated risk that person will end up in immigration proceeding.
So as an attorney who deals with these issues every day, I mean, what policies do you think need to be put into place to make the immigration system sustainable? I mean, I think, as you said, most everyone seems to agree something needs to be done.
Well, and I wrote articles 10, 15 years ago in the Salt Lake Tribune finding an answer to the immigration problem, and I've written dozens, more than a few dozen articles for the Tribune, for other newspapers. I'm tired of just repeating the same argument. I think what we really need to do is have a conversation that focuses on three questions. How do we want our immigration system to treat people who are coming here? Through family-based process, through employment processes. What do we want to do about the undocumented population that's here? 11, 12 million people living without documents. We need to address that, you know, be it drastically or be it more humanely. And what mechanisms should we have at the border and internally to improve compliance with and respect for the law? And for me, it's not a matter of these. I mean, I can give you specifics, but I would be characterized as liberal or conservative. What we really need, and this is me more as an activist, as a person who's written on the issue speaking, we need a serious conversation about the issue rather than dueling insults. and rather than, frankly, some of the racist rhetoric that's coming from the Trump administration and its enablers.
Okay, Mark, I need to leave it there. I sure appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for the conversation.
Well, friends of Ski Mountain Mining History will be hosting some hikes to historic mining structures around town. In the studio to tell us more about that, I have Don Roll with the group, along with Museum Director Sandra Morrison. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so Don, the first one this month, happening this week, actually sold out, huh?
Yes, it did over the weekend. We're going to be, thanks to Deer Valley Mountain Resorts, we're going to be holding a hike through history to the Flagstaff Mine. And that will be followed by a fantastic lunch at the Cushing's Cabin. And we're raising, we have 60 people signed up, which is the maximum we could take. We'll be raising over $4,000 that will go towards our mining structure stabilization efforts.
Okay, so do you have room then on the August 9th hike and lunch?
We do. By the way, it's August 8th. I made a typo in the... I realized last night I had a typo. It's Thursday, August 8th. Sandra, you want to cover that?
So we're hiking to the Thanes Conveyor, which is at Park City Mountain Resort. And thank you to Park City Mountain Resort for making that possible, riding the chairlift up so we don't have as much elevation gain that we have to walk. And that one is being catered by two of our volunteers who are wonderful amateur chefs and foodies. And so we'll be having a gourmet picnic actually at the conveyor. And then meeting with Clark Martinez, who's our contractor, who started the stabilization last week.
So the conveyor is located up there by the Thanes Chairlift, right?
Right by the Thanes Chair. It's that big, long structure that goes out onto the waste dump pile. And, yeah, and if you've noticed it lately, it's on a very precipitous lean. But luckily, it didn't fall over last winter. So it's very timely that he's up there this summer.
Okay. Know? And, again, that's what the... This is all about, just to kind of show people the demise of our historic mining structures and a way to help
save
them?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're so privileged that we have these structures still standing, and we want to save them, you know, for our kids and our kids' kids, future generations. It's what makes Park City different, our mining history. You know, we celebrate it at the museum, but it just brings it more alive when you actually can see these structures. And of course, we'll talk about how they worked. The conveyor still has the rock on the conveyor from when they turned it off back in, you know, 40 years ago. So it's a pretty interesting, and the design of it is very interesting as well.
Okay, even with the lift ride, it's still about 1,000-foot vertical hike.
Right,
so
yeah.
You do need to be in somewhat shaped
for
that.
Yeah, especially for the elevation, yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, but I mean, our locals are very fit and they're acclimatized and they love joining us for the historic hikes. So that one you can sign up online, parkcityhistory.org. And and it's $75 a person, $140 for a couple. And of course you get great food and drink too. And lots of history.
Yeah, I'd just like to thank Park City Market for providing the food for the August hike, and to Deer Valley Resorts for providing the lunch for tomorrow's hike.
Okay. Do you do this in the winter as well? Snowshoes or no?
No. Yeah, we used to do ski tours, and then the resorts took over, and they do them on a daily basis now. I mean, that's how popular Park City's mining history is. It's in the winter, it's every day. And, you know, a number of companies in town are offering guided hikes in the summer as well. And if you've missed out on our hike tomorrow to Deer Valley even has a hike the second Sunday of every month.
The third
Sunday of every month. So you can sign up for that one as well. So there's a lot of other opportunities.
Yeah, the next one is July 21st. It's $10. And if you go to the Deer Valley Resort website and click on Things to Do, you'll see the hikes listed there. And you can sign up in advance for $10. And they're all guided.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, Sandra, Don, need to leave it there. Thanks for your time
this
morning. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.